Hello. Later today, we meet the woman who has at least two dreams: to get more visually impaired young people involved in the sciences and to get herself working in space engineering.
When I was 6 years old, a family friend gave me a large print book all about questions and answers of space, and I was pretty much hooked since then.
Well, if she does succeed, that might mean more visually impaired people needing support in the workplace. But if the rumours are right, support via the government's Access to Work scheme might be harder to come by. The Department for Work and Pensions has up until now been adamant that there have been no changes in policy over issues like eligibility criteria or levels of support in the workplace. But only yesterday, we've heard that Access to Work staff have been told by Disability Minister Sir Stephen Timms to be more scrupulous when applying the guidance. And we continue to hear from people telling us that their support has been reduced or in some cases taken away completely, whether in terms of support workers being removed or paid less, or applicants being denied the special equipment they need to do their job. We've been pressing for a minister to come onto the programme to clarify the situation for us. Again, this week, no one was available. There will, though, be a statement later, but it's not just us who can't get the clarifications we seek. Liberal Democrat spokesman on work and pensions Steve Darling has been putting written questions to the department and isn't satisfied with the answers. Steve, first of all, what have you been hearing about Access to Work awards as a constituency MP?
I've been hearing from both constituents in my own patch and from colleagues across the country exactly what you're highlighting. It's particularly people who have normally had a level of service and they're looking at cuts to sometimes below the minimum wage charge of those who are supporting them, or perhaps cuts that are making it difficult for them to actually go to work. That's without talking about the significant delays that there is within the system, which is another story.
So what did you ask in Parliament and what were you told?
Well, as soon as we got back after the summer on the 1st of September, the first questions I asked were around access to work and whether there had been a change and whether guidance had changed to those who undertake this with the DWP. And the response was, no, there hasn't been any changes. However, they may have been a change in the way that guidance is applied. So it does feel very much like stealth cuts that are happening to this much needed service.
You've been described as having talked about this as a cover up. Is that what you think is happening?
It does feel very much like a cover up because for months and months, I and I know other colleagues have been raising questions around access to work. The reality on the ground is that there are reductions in service. And yet the ministers are being like a traffic cop at an accident, saying there's nothing to see here when we know that there is something very unpleasant happening behind the scenes.
I mean, we've heard of two FOIs, Freedom of Information requests, which have been turned down, one seeking more information about operational changes over the past 2 years. That was turned down because it was deemed too wide-ranging. And one about who were the members of the collaboration committee about access to work, turned down because of data protection rules. Well, amongst the dissatisfied claimants that we've heard about is Sassy Wyatt. And Sassy joins us. She's a blind freelance travel journalist and an accessibility consultant. So Sassy, just explain a bit more about what you do and why you need support workers to do it.
I have to communicate with brands and businesses, whether that is to upload social media content or to put forward portfolios in order to work with my next clients. And as a totally blind screen reader user, over 90% of the internet is not accessible to me. But I also have other disabilities which give me severe chronic illness, brain fog and brain fatigue, which then leads me to needing support workers, not just to be my eyes, but to kind of be my hands and my backpack and everything in between.
And I think you do sort of live presentations and so forth. So presumably there are things like PowerPoint displays and that kind of thing that you have to do.
Yes, absolutely. So it's not just preparing the PowerPoint slides themselves, which can be very tricky to do. But when you're physically presenting and using, say, a clicker and setting up the technology, you know, everybody uses a different system no matter where you go. So I'm always in need of a sighted support worker to help me manage these tasks, because at the end of the day, if the people at the conference themselves don't know how to set it up and I don't know how to set it up, then we're not going to be getting a very good showing.
So what's happened over your application to have your support worker renewed, which I think you put in towards the end of last year?
Yeah, so I put in my application on the 18th of December because Access to Work made it very clear back then that there was a backlog. There is over 63,000 people still waiting for any sort of confirmation. But I had a three-year award I was renewing. And in the renewal process, everything went well. I was confirmed that my award had been put forward. And I'd be hearing back from Access to Work, you know, pretty soon. Not only did they not do that, the government's Access to Work scheme for reapplication is only to meet the lower earnings threshold. So I proved that I met the lower earnings threshold. And yet I was still questioned as to why I needed it and how my disability not just affected me, but why I needed such radical support.
I think the real point is you thought that this award had been confirmed and reinstated and therefore thought you were able to go on paying your support workers, but that now isn't the case. Therefore, you, or perhaps you would say the Department of Work and Pension, owes them money.
Yes, and that is the biggest issue. Is I basically had a 2.5 month period where they were taking time to respond to me. And I had in writing that my award had been confirmed. So I started back up work with my support workers. One of them I worked with very, very heavily. And so she's done about 2.5 months worth of work and has not received a single penny from the Department of Work and Pensions.
What effect has all this had on you and perhaps just as significantly on your business?
Well, my business has really taken a turn for the worst. This year was meant to be sort of my best, not just financial year, but more of a, for me as a brand, because I've released a book. I had many public speaking opportunities globally, and I've had to reduce, if not cancel, half of the engagements and client work because I don't have the support that I need in order to do my job.
Well, thank you very much for telling your story. Also joining us is Amanda Hawkins, who's part of the senior leadership team at the RNIB. Now, there have been so-called collaboration committees meeting over Access to Work, amongst other things. And shortly, a review is to start, again with a group which will concentrate on Access to Work policy in the future. Has the RNIB been involved in any of these?
We're not a member of the government's Access to Work collaboration, although I think we do need to be. I think we're the main sort of advocate, especially around this area. So we'll be pushing very hard to get a realistic and meaningful consultation around this issue.
I mean, how hard are you pushing your message through? The government said that this process will be collaborative, that it'll take into account the views of organisations representing disabled people. How's the RNIB getting its message across?
This is the biggest single issue that RNIB employment team are coming up against. I think our role at the moment is to collect that data and to make sure the government is hearing it. I don't think there's anything stronger than people's lived experience and making sure that there is good consultation and that we're representing those voices and trying to get into those meetings to make sure that the right Access to Work system comes out of this review.
Are they listening to you?
I think that's to be seen in the future. I would say that we've got a job to do on this one.
Do you know who has or who would have specific knowledge of the needs of visually impaired people in employment? Who else could be doing what you feel you should be doing?
Well, I think we work across the sector. So there's many of the charities, including in the sector. I think making sure that we're working together and pulling in that data and trying to get that into this consultation. But I think, like your other speakers have said, I think it's been quite difficult to do that. And it's having quite a big impact. And I very much, from an employment stance, recognise SASI's kind of experience there. One of my own direct employees has been trying to renegotiate now for about a year, has had his award cut down from 7 hours at £25 to 6 hours at £15, which means his support worker can't work. It takes his support worker into that below minimum wage. And he's been told that if he doesn't accept the new offer, then he'll have to wait for a new assessment. And the new assessments are sitting at about 9 to 11 months. So he won't be able to do his role. He won't have the same dignity at work that everybody else would have because he doesn't have the right tools to do that.
One of the things government is rumoured to be thinking, and I talk about rumours because of the difficulty we've had in getting direct information, is that employers should bear more of the responsibility for meeting the costs of reasonable adjustments for disabled people at work. Now, some people might feel that's not an unreasonable thing for them to do.
I personally think that's not the right thing to do because I think you then create a culture of somebody coming into a workplace with a burden that the employer might have to think about. So there will be an opportunity to discriminate at that recruitment stage. We've also got this other message coming from government that we want to get more people with a disability back to work and the support will be there. But that's not what we're seeing. I think it's just a very strange conflict at the moment between these two messages that are coming out.
Amanda Hawkins, Steve Darling, Sassy Wyatt, thank you all very much indeed. Well, the Department for Work and Pensions did send us the following statement. It's been read by a member of our team.
We inherited an access to work scheme that is failing both employees and employers, which is why, as part of our welfare reform, we consulted on how it could be improved. We are reviewing all aspects of the scheme and will develop future policy with disabled people and the organisations that represent them.
Now, if you were listening to last week's programme, you'll have heard Haseeb Jabbar explaining that though he was passionate and knowledgeable about computers, he'd been discouraged from studying them further at school and college, but how by sheer persistence, he's now doing well with a global technology company. Well, this story seemed to chime precisely with a charity that science and engineering enthusiast Abby Way is in the process of setting up to give support to young people who might be in a similar situation to Haseeb, keen to make science or technology a career, but not getting the support and encouragement they need to pursue the sciences. Abby joins me. Abby, the charity is called Boomerang. Just tell me a bit more about it and what it'll do.
Boomerang is aimed at supporting and inspiring young visually impaired people into STEM subjects, STEM being science, technology, engineering and maths. These are subjects which are really difficult for visually impaired students to access. Sometimes the teachers don't know how to support the students, and that can result in students being told that they can't take part in science experiments or they should just watch their friend do it. Simple things like how to be able to read the beakers in science or spot the colour changes. And unfortunately, there's also a lot of stereotype and bias that these subjects aren't for people who are visually impaired, which is obviously nonsense, but Boomerang hopefully will be there to encourage those children and students that they can do it, and it doesn't matter what the teachers are saying or the parents are saying or other adults are saying. Hopefully Boomerang will give them the confidence and the knowledge in the area they're interested to go into that classroom and say, actually, I can and I will do this and you're not going to tell me otherwise.
So to what extent is this based on your own experiences at school and at college?
My secondary school didn't understand how to support me, and there was a lot of barriers that shouldn't have been in place that were simple things like if the teachers use the wrong colour pen or if they're drawing diagrams too small, that whole lesson can be wasted so quickly. And as soon as you start to fall behind on content, that accumulates over time. And at the end of the day, you get sat in front of an exam and you only know half the content for it. It's an impossible task.
So tell me a bit more about how you hope Boomerang will work, because I know you're in the early stages of this. I think you want to set up mentoring groups, among other things.
Yes, Boomerang's going to have three main goals. The first, which I'm currently working on, is a website network community where parents, teachers and students can all connect and share their tips. So hopefully that will give the teachers a place to go and ask for support if they don't know how to support the child and take the onus off the student a little bit, because it's really difficult when you're younger to advocate for yourself and go into class and tell the teacher, who's obviously senior to you, how to manage in those situations. And then there's the mentoring scheme, which will be a few years down the line, where hopefully older students like myself can be matched up with younger students. And if there's, say, chemistry homework that they can't do because they've missed the content, we can help with that. And just kind of encouraging them to follow their passions in STEM, sharing our tips. And then the final one, which is the one that I'm personally most excited for, is boomerang events. So we're taking these children out of the classroom and into an environment, maybe like a factory or a museum, but tailoring the whole experience to make it fully accessible to them in a way that is very difficult to find at the moment.
I think you've already done a few experiments, as it were, in this with kids who are still at school. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yes. So I did a pilot event whilst I was working with Airbus Defence and Space a few years ago. And I had the opportunity to bring four children who were blind and visually impaired around site. And it was an amazing day. We went and found loads of broken bits of satellites so they could feel and touch a real spacecraft, if you like. We had sense of what the different planets smelt like. We had 3D printed models of the moon and satellites. And we had the Mars rover, which Airbus has got like a life-size prototype of. And the children were able to come up onto the sand and touch the actual Mars rover that Airbus are working on. We took them inside some of the ovens that we use for our materials. It was an amazing day.
Right. Now, of course, this has always been one of your ambitions, hasn't it, to work in the space industry?
Absolutely.
Tell me about that. How did that start?
So, a bit of a cliche story, but when I was 6 years old, a family friend gave me a large print book all about questions and answers of space. And I was pretty much hooked since then. I've been fascinated by it and always thought it's been such an interesting topic. And I've followed through with that with my engineering and had the amazing opportunity to do my placement with a space company like Airbus. So hopefully we'll see where I end up in the next few years.
And I mean, what do you think are the obstacles there specifically, and what are your chances of overcoming them?
I've got this far, so there's no point letting any obstacles get in my way now. To an extent, the further on you go with building your career, it gets a little bit harder because you're almost expecting to have made it, and then there's another barrier and another barrier. But at the same time, having got so far, you're beginning to have a little catalogue of things that prove to the rest of the world that actually you are capable and you can do it, and you wouldn't be in this position if you didn't have the drive and the passion and the abilities.
So, key question, when will Boomerang be launched, and how can people get involved?
Very soon. So I've started on the website. I've been given a timeline of about 2 months to develop that. If you have any questions, feel free to email me. My email is abigailway@btinternet.com. It is really important to me that Boomerang is for and by the children and the students who need it. So if you're listening and you yourself have an idea, or you know someone who is really passionate about a certain area in science or maths or engineering or technology, get in touch, and I want to see what Boomerang can do to make that happen for you.
Abby Way, we'll follow your progress with great interest. Thanks very much for joining us. And that's it for today. We would, as always, like to hear from you. You can email intouch@bbc.co.uk, or you can call with a voice message 0161 836 1338. From me, Peter White, and producer Beth Hemmings, goodbye.